Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing great, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
I'd like to give a special thank you to Kelly Von Cannon. She had suggested that we cover the Jesse Pomeroy case, aka the Boston Boy Fiend. So thank you, Kelly.
Very creepy historical case. I enjoyed doing it.
Justin, you interviewed David Politis, and over the years, we've gotten many, many requests to interview this guy because of his missing 411 books.
Yeah, when those things were being released, he started out like 6 years ago, and I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago was when the requests started happening. We'd actually reached out, but I think at that point he had switched gears and was starting to work on a documentary called Missing 411.
Yeah, I had written to him several times, letting him know, hey, I'm Aaron, and Justin is my co-host on Generation Y, and we've been flooded with requests to interview you and never heard anything. At one point, someone actually offered me his personal number, and I was like, no. You know, I'm sure he's busy. And, well, we ended up getting the interview anyway, which I think is very exciting. Justin has checked out other interviews with him, and I think we'll have a pretty good interview on our hands. Don't you, Justin?
Yeah. I take a different route with him than some of the other interviews he's done. And if you haven't seen the documentary Missing 411, go check it out. Super cool. I was entranced by it. And we have some ties to this, don't we?
Yeah, in a way we do. It's been a little while, but at one point I interviewed Alan Atadero about his son Jared, who had gone missing in the Colorado Mountains. And I'll tell you what, that was a very emotional interview. I know Justin and I have spoken about interviews that we've done. And for him, Kerry Max Cook was an emotional interview. For me, Alan Atadero, and I can't say it enough, his book, When the Sun Sets, is amazing. I think everybody should read it. It's one of the best edited books I've ever read in my life. And I have been a voracious reader since I was a kid. So I highly recommend that. Now, Alan Atadero has worked with David Politis and is in this documentary. His son, Jared, is one of the featured cases. So I would recommend checking out that interview again and checking out the book. But most of all, if you know anything about David Politis or want to know more, I would check out this interview that you're about to hear with Justin, because highly requested guest, and he's very difficult to schedule as well.
Exactly.
But we're happy to have him.
So without further ado, here's Dave. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Dave. Go ahead and introduce yourself. I think a lot of people already know who you are, though.
My name is Dave Politis. I'm from San Jose, California, originally. Grew up in the Bay Area. Worked for two police departments, Fremont and San Jose Police. Spent 17 years with San Jose, three with Fremont. Ended up retiring, went into human resources for several years, retired again, and then got into doing some research into the unusual. And I live right now in Denver, Colorado.
Oh, Denver's nice.
Oh, it's really nice. No, I love it here.
Yeah. And when you were in law enforcement, I guess, what are some of the positions you held? Were you a patrol cop, SWAT team?
Yeah, I started where everyone does, in the patrol car. And then I went to the street crimes unit, and those are the decoy teams in the city, and you dress up like an old man or a victim, and you lay in alleyways, and you have a team around you that watches, and guys come in and steal your money, and people arrest them. And I did that for a long time, and that was a lot of fun, actually. Then I went to Vice Intelligence, worked that, worked on the SWAT team for a while, worked on Sexual Registrant Task Force for a while. And all the teams and things I worked on, they were high profile, proactive units. They were always a lot of fun.
It sounds like anyone that would want to be a police officer would want to get into one of these departments, and you did them all. So it's a very exciting career there.
I was very lucky.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure the SWAT team is 2 weeks of prep for 2 minutes of action, but still it's pretty cool.
It's insane. I mean, you practice and you train for days and days on end. Some weeks, 50% of our time was just doing nothing but training. Mm-hmm. And then on the other time, you were in an unmarked patrol car. If we drove by you, you'd say, oh, that's a police car. But we'd be in uniform, and we could go anywhere in the city we wanted to. And our goal was to initiate arrests. So we went out, and we really had the world by the tail. And there was a lot of fun to be had, because we could move all throughout the 150 square miles of San Jose.
Okay. Yeah, that's crazy. And that gives you a good, I think, background on some of the investigative journalism stuff you're doing, because you have the investigative side, the at least law enforcement point of view on how these things are playing out.
Well, you know, when you go to the police academy, they teach you a little bit. And then during your career, if you want to, as a policeman, you can go to different schools that are put on by Drug Enforcement Administration, homicide detectives, FBI task forces. All these groups put on classes. And if you're interested, you go to a lot of them and you learn a lot, and you bring it back to your hometown. And it kind of teaches you how to do an investigation the right way.
Nice. Good to know. I try to be active in my local community. I've gone to the local police department, will put on use of force seminars. I've gone on police ride-alongs just to familiarize myself more with their side of the house. And that's kind of the whole point of, you know, the podcast, is to educate people on things that they might not know about, especially with our system, with our law enforcement. So what sparked your attention to go from law enforcement to a totally different career path, such as investigative journalism and the missing 411?
Well, I was doing some peripheral research on another topic at a national park. I'd already had a couple books that were published. And while I was at this park, I noticed a couple of park rangers following me around. And at the end of the day, I went to my lodge room, which was off the park property, and I get a knock on the door, and it's one of these rangers, and I recognized him. He's in plain clothes, and he said, hey, we know who you were, and we have some information for you that we think you should look into. We know your background, your investigative experience, and you know how to write, and we think this would be perfect for you. And he went about telling me a story of him and this other person worked in several different national parks during their career. They had seen several and worked several disappearances of people on the property. And they realized that during that first 7 to 10 days, there was a lot of publicity and there was a lot of effort to find the person. Then after that period of time, everything stopped and there was no more publicity. There was no more investigation. There was no more nothing. And it bothered him. And it bothered him for a couple different reasons. The locations sometimes where the people disappeared didn't make sense. Sometimes the effort put into it after the disappearance didn't make sense, meaning there was nothing done. They made an effort to find reports sometimes and they were thwarted and they couldn't locate certain things and it bothered them. And then when they kind of met up together, these two people, they compared notes and compared concerns and they realized that they were both thinking the same way and both had experienced similar things in different national parks. And there are, on our website, there's a couple of links there where other park rangers have tried to file Freedom of Information Act requests against the Park Service for information in which they should have been easily granted, and they were thwarted. This is public information, and the park rangers were upfront about it, that, you know, it's weird that they can't even get their own information. But they said I should look into it. So I met with both of them, and then eventually I called a friend of mine that was in law enforcement. I said, hey, this is what I heard. Is there anything to this? And on the way home, he called me back and he says, wow, there is something to this. There's a lot of people that have disappeared there, a lot of open cases. And that's kind of how it got started. During that first couple of weeks, I knew that the National Park Service had the largest contingent of federally trained law enforcement officers in the United States, and that's the National Park Police. They're trained at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. They're highly skilled, highly trained, good people, and they know how to do the job the right way. And because of that, we knew that we could file against them and get a list of missing people easily, because that's protocol A number one on any investigation to a mass scale. And when we filed against them, several months later, I get a call back from the National Park attorney asking me why I wanted the information. That's very, very, very odd. And it says in the Freedom of Information Act, our government can't refuse or deny access to information based on why we want it.
Yeah.
And I was a little concerned. And I said, well, why are you asking this question? Oh, we're just interested. And I said, well, I'm just doing research. And he says, well, we don't have any lists. I go, what do you mean you don't have lists? He goes, we don't have any lists of missing people in our system. I said, you mean the parks don't have lists? Headquarters doesn't have lists? No, nobody has lists.
On one side, I'm slightly shocked and dismayed that he's saying they don't have lists. On the other side, I'm not so surprised, because they don't keep lists of, say, police shootings. They don't keep lists of a lot of things. Or it's so, soloed out amongst so many different departments that compiling that list would be a logistical nightmare, and they just don't feel like dealing with it, right?
Well, I hesitate to disagree with you.
No, go ahead. I mean, I'm just thinking I would expect them to have a list because they're federal. They're all connected. But on the flip side, I'm kind of like, well, maybe they just don't have a good system and they're lazy.
If any of your listeners went into any of their police department or sheriff's departments in the nation, mm-hmm. anything larger than, say, 40, 50 people, that chief would have a list on his desk of all missing people in his jurisdiction within an hour if he requested it.
Yeah.
That's how basic the information is. Now, the National Park Police have about 200 different pieces of property across the U.S. that they control and that they patrol. Now, first of all, does the National Park Service understand the importance of a list? Well, they keep inventory lists of the number of toilet paper rolls in their parks. They keep lists of the number of movies made on National Park Service property. That's on our website. The value of lists in relation to law enforcement are extremely important. It shows trends. It shows locations of liability, possibly, if the same person disappeared in the same people disappeared in the same location year after year, show that there was a problem. It is also politically incomprehensible that a police department doesn't have a list of missing people on their property. And the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children would say, no, they have a list. They're just not showing it to you. This is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, George Knapp, who's probably one of the most famous investigative journalists in the world, was interviewed for our movie, and he flatly said the National Park Service is lying. Mm-hmm. They have a list. They don't want to give it to you. And when I started this probably 6-7 years ago now, I had a journalist come on and say, Dave, you tell the National Park Service I'll buy them the laptop and install the Excel spreadsheet, and they can put that in their headquarters, and they can have an intern that's working for them that's paid nothing to do a job of maintaining a database of missing people on their property, and they could have that together in 3 to 4 months, and that is the truth. It would cost them nothing to do it.
I don't even think it would be 3 or 4 months, actually. It could be done in a week. I mean, it's just data entry.
Right. The attorney, they said that they didn't have a list. Mm-hmm. We talked about it. We thought it was maybe something in the semantics because we could not believe that they were denying us.
Yeah, yeah.
So we reapplied. We again were told that, no, they didn't have a list. And I said, well, I'm a published author, so I'm going to claim the Freedom of Information Act exclusion from fees. And because I'm a published author, I want you to put together a list for me and I'll write about it. Mm-hmm. 2 months later, they came back to me and they said, well, we did some research and your books aren't in enough libraries to qualify.
That means jack and shit. That has no bearing on anything. But yeah.
Well, that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
In the Freedom of Information Act, there's no wording about, oh, you got to have your books in so many libraries.
Yeah.
And I told them that and they said, well, that's an internal policy of ours. And I said, well, what's the number of books in the number of libraries? Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, we don't have that in front of us right now. So in essence, we lost strike two. So strike three is we asked them, what would you charge us to put together a list of missing people from Yosemite National Park and from your entire system? And a couple weeks later, he comes back and he says, well, from Yosemite, it's going to be $34,000. And from our entire system, that'll cost you $1.4 million.
Now, I'd like to say, refer back to the laptop and the intern who could have done it in a week. But yeah, those numbers are astronomical.
Right.
And it's an internal policy. I don't care with what company, private or government, does not trump a constitutional right or Freedom of Information Act. But of course, in order for you to fight that, you would have to take them all the way up to the Supreme Court. And who has that time or money? So this is just them shutting you down.
Oh, absolutely it is.
What is a park ranger or park service's job responsibilities if it's not to maintain a list? I get that there's some conservation going on. They make sure that people aren't poaching, but wouldn't this be in their wheelhouse? Isn't a list of missing persons absolutely something that would be in their job title or job responsibility?
So you got to understand that there's a couple different classifications of rangers, but the normal ranger you see in the park that's talking to you about botany and fish and insects in the park, those people are not enforcement rangers. Enforcement rangers carry a gun. Their job is law enforcement. That's their sole job is law enforcement. And depending on the park is dependent upon the number of enforcement rangers they have. And those people are specially trained to carry guns, use of deadly force, et cetera, not like the normal rangers you see around the park.
Okay, yeah.
Now the enforcement rangers are in marked cars. They look kind of like police cars. Now, once they, say, take a crime of, say, assault with a deadly weapon against a park visitor, they'll write the report. They'll do that initial investigation. And then it goes to a classification inside the Park Service called Special Investigator. And those are special agents assigned to the Park Service employees that are essentially the detectives for the National Park Service police. And then they're the ones, most of them have 1, 2, or 3 parks assigned to them. And they're the ones that follow up on the big cases and do the extensive investigations into criminal activity. Now, the important point for your audience to understand is in law enforcement, there's only one thing that we investigate that isn't criminal activity, and that's a missing person. Mm-hmm. Because it's not illegal if you decide to go missing, yeah. And it's not a crime. To get a classification as a missing person, it means that there's no criminal activity involved, there's no suspects of a crime, there's no crime being perpetrated. It's a straight missing person case. It has a lot different meaning to police, and a lot of guys in law enforcement really don't want to work them, because a vast majority of the time you find out, well, the person just wanted to fall out of society. I spent all these hours investigating it for nothing. It's kind of a worthless time on my part, but he's okay. I'm on my way.
Yeah. But here we have, it's still a category. It's a missing person. And if they can go through a database, a ticket tracking system, requests, whatever, and say, I don't really want to work that because it might be a waste of my time, means there's a list. Because they're looking at it and they're choosing to take an assault charge or some other case because it's more active, it's more criminal, it's something that they'll feel better about doing at the end of the day, as opposed to something that they may or may not have any payoff for. But you just prove that there's a list because they're looking at all these different incidents that they have to go through in a day on their normal job.
You're singing my song. I mean, I've always believed there was one.
Yeah. And apparently if you had $1 million, they would give it to you.
$1.4 million.
Yeah.
Right.
But you create your own list and you have a lot of success with this.
Well, I think what happened was, is that when the Park Service essentially lied to our face, they got a lot of people upset. And a lot of people that were friends of mine that are in this investigative journalist platform, they stepped in and started helping and working. And over the course of the next 6 years, we went through a lot of archives, dug through a lot of data, read thousands of reports. And when you read 10 reports on missing people at 10 different locations, it really doesn't mean a lot. And you don't glean a lot of special effects out of it. But when you read 5,000 cases, then certain things start to fall out, mm-hmm. and certain things keep rising to the surface as unusual. And after reading just a couple hundred, several of the search and rescue reports started to sound like they were written by the same people, even though they were decades apart and thousands of miles apart. The same thing was happening. Namely, they'd bring a search and rescue team to the scene to look for the missing person. They'd put a canine on the ground, and many times the canine would walk in a circle and lay down, and the handler couldn't determine if the dog didn't want to track or there was no scent to track. This happens time and time again. And I can tell you, being on the SWAT team where the canines were assigned to us, those dogs just live for searching for people. Good guys, bad guys, it doesn't matter. They just love getting out there and working. And so to hear about a dog that lays down, walks in a circle, sits at its master's feet, something's wrong. Something's not right. The other part of that is, in congruence with this, they bring in extra expert trackers, and they should be able to track a person point to point. And the trackers can't find anything past the point where the person was last seen, or maybe 10 or 20 feet down the trail, and then there's nothing there. That's not normal. And what we developed after all these years is a series of profile points, and it's similar to what an FBI profiler does when they're looking for someone who's committed a series of crimes. There's certain things about that activity that rise to the top that are different than everything else. And in profiling all these cases, those are two of the profile points. Many of them happen in close proximity to water. In many, many of the instances, the victim is found in an area that had been searched sometimes 5, 10, 15, 20 times, then all of a sudden they're found in that same area where searchers had gone over many, many times. And it's not to call the searchers inept, but nobody believes the victim was there when they were searching, and then all of a sudden they appear. If the victim's found, 9 times out of 10, they can't remember what happened. That's not normal. Many times, victims disappear in or around a boulder field or granite. And the largest boulder field in the world made of granite is Yosemite National Park. The largest cluster of missing people anywhere in the world is Yosemite National Park. Now, after you look at 5,000 or 6,000 cases and you vet them down using these profile points, and you vet out the cases where there's human to human involvement, meaning there's a crime.
Yeah.
You vet out voluntary disappearances, you vet out mental health issues, and you vet out animal predation. meaning a mountain lion, bear attack, etc. And you vet that out because search and rescue will do that right when they're on the scene. Once you get rid of all those cases, you're left with these matching ones.
And when they vet out, say, the animal attack, it's they're looking for animal prints. They're looking for traces of clothing that might have been ripped apart, blood, lots of different items there to really exclude that. Because if an animal does attack a human, there's going to be some sort of sign of struggle or prints left.
Absolutely. And you will usually find pieces of that victim within 10 to 50 feet of where they were last seen. Mm-hmm. And you will hear a scream or a yell, pieces of clothing, drag marks in the dirt, on the grass, in the soil, blood, tissue, hair from the predator. I mean, it's a pretty telltale area, easy to find. It isn't real rocket science. Yeah. And I always tell people, hey, does anyone realize that in the last 150 years, how many mountain lion attacks there have been in North America?
I only know because I've heard a few of your interviews, but go ahead and say the number.
So mountain lion attacks where a human was killed in the U.S. and Canada, 14. It is extremely rare. Extremely rare.
Yeah.
It essentially hardly ever happens. So when you want to point your finger to that, you can't. So anyhow, when we glean all this out, and then we come up with this stack of reports, and then we start to realize, well, there's these geographical clusters of missing people that match these profile points. And we throw them on the ground, we put them around the room, then we put up a map of North America, and we come up with 59 geographical clusters. 80% of those are within 150 to 200 miles of a major body of water, meaning the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, or the Great Lakes.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts, and when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
When you're talking about these clusters, are these places more frequented by tourists? Are these high traffic areas? Is that possibly one explanation of why more people would go missing in these areas? Or are there plenty of high traffic areas around the country that should have similar missing?
Well, when we first started, we looked at just national parks. Mm-hmm. First couple books came out, and then all of a sudden people started saying, oh, you ought to look at the Klamath National Forest because there's been a series of disappearances there. And we'd look, and wow, those disappearances match what's in national parks. So we opened it up to U.S. force. Then we opened it up to open space areas owned by the Department of the Interior, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we opened it up to a point where almost all rural areas now. And yeah, you know, you could say, well, maybe these are high trafficked areas. Okay, so, but how can somebody disappear from a high trafficked area in the middle of the wilderness and not leave a scent trail, not leave tracks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? This doesn't make sense.
I know that people go missing. You know, there's the whole Maura Murray incident. I've covered many cases where they have searched, say, a very treacherous field or rocky area and weren't able to find anybody, and then later on able to find, say, a shirt or even the body. But there are some cases where the person's found is not something that would have been missed. I mean, I get that search and rescue has a really hard job. They're in the mountains, they're in the woods, and things can be missed. But sometimes the missing person, the victim, what have you, will show up literally in the middle of the path that they've been walking up and down, correct?
Well, there's a case I write about that every morning the search and rescuers took this same path out to the search zone. And it wasn't long. It was maybe, you know, half mile. Well, on the eighth or ninth day of the search, a tree had fallen across the path, and the victim, a little boy, deceased, was laying on top of the tree. How strange is that?
Yeah. So that's not that they didn't see him there before, you know, where, oh, he was just in a bush and they just missed it. This was, whoa, wait a second. There's here. He's been deposited here, if you will.
Well, there's that. And then many, many times search and rescue in an effort not to miss anything, meaning any type of evidence on the ground, a victim discards, say, a handkerchief, they'll walk almost shoulder to shoulder through a grid space to make sure they've covered it all. And it's those type of searches that days and weeks later, the victim turns up in the middle of it, deceased. Many times, this is another oddity, is that the coroner can't determine the cause of death. And since I came out with my third book, I've had two coroners call me and say, hey, you know what, Dave, you're telling the truth. We know that certain things out there are happening that we don't understand that are taking people's lives, and we can't explain how the life is taken. Well, since then, and since I've talked about it on shows, I get emails from people, well, Dave, it's pretty obvious. They, you know, and this is, I'll just tell you a few of the things I hear is, I hear people say, well, that something stole their soul, so they died. Or they got scared to death and they died. Mm-hmm. Well, whatever the reason is they died, nobody knows because the coroners can't figure it out.
I mean, there's certain aspects of, say, hypothermia or exposure that they can find. They can see if you have frostbite, or normally they can determine the cause of death when it's something that's nature related, such as exposure. So
absolutely,
you know, and in some of your cases, you talk about the victims found and they've shed all their clothes. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, that's something that people that are suffering from hypothermia do, is they all of a sudden get really hot and they peel their clothes off, or they've been out in nature for a week or two and they're just losing their mind with no food and water and they take their clothes off. But you have some points about that also, don't you?
Well, I think that's an easy way for people to dismiss it and for their mind to go into a comfort zone on the topic. But the reality is, I have many cases where the clothing was found within eyesight of the location where they disappeared, meaning there was no time for hypothermia to set in. I have other cases where the victim was so small and such a toddler, the parents said, our son, our daughter, couldn't take their clothes off and couldn't disrobe and couldn't get rid of them like that. So if you guys think they did it, you're insane. So I hear that all the time. Yet in the news media, we'll get, oh, you know, they died of hypothermia, they shed their clothes. But then when you get down and you start interviewing people and they say, yeah, well, we told this to the media and they didn't want to print it. They didn't want to talk about it.
It's almost as if the speculation is they just don't want to go there. And the media,
It's always weird to me what the media will publish and what they won't. My wife and I have both been interviewed and we'll give this 15-minute speech about something or other, and then they'll take one phrase where I make a joke and that goes in the commercial or in their news article, and I'm like, really? That's it? That's what you put in there? it's ridiculous. So I don't have a lot of faith in media. And as you know, as a researcher, most news articles will just get replicated out hundreds of thousands of times without any fact checking. And it's just, it's nonsense at this point. What you can really say is the true story. And unless you speak to some of the people that are on the ground when it happened, it's really hard to come up with the truth.
Well, after reading thousands of missing person cases and search and rescue reports, I've written this in my books that the discrepancies between the reports and what the news represents it to be are sometimes night and day. And initially, I was attacked by some people saying, well, it couldn't be that much. And then some people on their own went out and got the reports and said, no, it really was that much. Yeah. And Dave's not lying. The press got it that wrong. Or they didn't want to explain what happened. And so they left this out.
I'm just wondering, when you've approached the federal government and the National Park Service and the media, and you're asking these questions, do you think it's a money issue? Like this park brings in a lot of tourism, so therefore they don't want to scare people away, and it's just all a whole big money thing, and there's pride that they don't want to scar the, you know, persona of this nice mountainous town or something to that effect?
Well, let me ask you, Justin, you saw the movie. Yeah. When we questioned the former head of the National Park Service and asked them if there was a list of missing people, how would you explain his reaction?
To me, it was a mix of disdain and disinterest. He just looked like, I'm not going to answer this question. I just don't have any interest in engaging you.
Yeah, but, and yeah. If you were a victim's family, how would that make you feel, right?
Crappy. And we even interviewed Alan Atadero, and he explains it point by point on the complete lack of interest and even abrasiveness of law enforcement when searching for his own son. And they threatened to arrest him and other independent search and rescue people, volunteers, for trespassing if they go search for his son.
We've heard that more than once. I heard that from Alan, and I heard that from another family at another national park. I've heard national park people tell families that they can't hire a helicopter because the airspace above a park is restricted, which is a lie. I've heard them tell so many things just to thwart their efforts to find their loved ones. It's baffling, and I have no idea why they're doing it.
Yeah, it's disgusting to me, and it makes me lose a lot of respect and faith in the system when I hear those stories, because you would think you call 911, you call law enforcement for help. These are the people that are supposed to come in and take over. And then when you see that they're not even interested in taking over, they're not applying all effort, or you just realize that their level of effort is minuscule compared to what you could do on your own. And then I think, well, just get out of the way and just let me do it myself if you're not going to bother looking for my son, my daughter, my wife, what have you. But then if you want to do it yourself, then you're going to be threatened with arrest. You're going to be told to get out of the way, or that you're making the search harder or more difficult for them.
Yes, definitely.
When I listened to Alan's interview, I wanted to just punch my phone because I couldn't get through it. It was too much for me to hear, because I would put myself in his shoes, whether it be a family member or any loved one. And I could not be as level-headed and as well-spoken and calm as he was.
Well, I will say, I'm sure that Alan was pretty vocal about what was told to him. I consider him one of my best friends. He's a really, really good guy. I wrote an extensive chapter in the book about him and his son. But he had a right to be. And he had a right to be upset. And not without coming forward and giving the man answers and helping him search out those answers. I don't understand how any law enforcement agency, their leader can go to bed at night with a clear conscience, because it's horrific.
He's just one of the ones that sticks out the most as far as the egregious behavior of the search effort and law enforcement against him. There are a lot of other cases, though, that are more mysterious and less frustrating. I remember hearing you talk about the boy, Dennis Lloyd, who went missing on one of your interviews. And there was two families, the Martins, that were letting the children play and go hide and seek. And then the boy disappears right under the family's noses. And then one of the families witnesses a man running up on a hill or something to that effect. And none of this is reported or investigated at all. And I'm thinking, you have two families here that were on scene. How does a child disappear just out of thin air within 5 minutes of playing a game of hide and seek?
Yeah, in the middle of nowhere. Now, there's a lot of questions. There's more questions than answers, unfortunately. But, a few years ago, Les Stroud got a hold of me, Survivor Man. And he had read some of my books. And he said, you know, Dave, you're really onto something here. He says, if I can ever help you, he goes, please let me know. And he goes, I'd like to help you in any way I can. And I said, that's great, Les. Thanks. And about the time we started to put together some idea about making the movie, we thought, now, wouldn't it be cool to bring Les on board as the expert and have him try to replicate a path that a child took across the mountains in the middle of the night to see if Les could do it and see how quickly he could do it? And that may be the way to get people to understand the complexity of what we're trying to explain. And what we did was we took a case out of northeastern Oregon where a small boy, 2-year-old boy, was playing with his brother and sister and some cousins around a barn not far from their house. And mom calls him for dinner, and half the kids run around one side of the barn, half go around the other. This little boy disappears. And 19 hours later, and at least 12 miles from the barn, they find his body laying face down in the snow. Well, we were able to get a hold of people who were involved in this, and they laid out the path and showed us the location, and we brought Les out there, and the boy disappeared at 4 in the afternoon and was found at 7 the next morning. And it was in the wintertime, so we had Les try to replicate it in those conditions during those hours. And several hours into the darkness, he says, hey, I can't do this. He goes, this is insanity. He goes, first of all, you can't walk a straight line. Second of all, you don't know where you're walking to. And he says, I have kids. And he said, I can guarantee if my son was lost at 2 years old, he's not walking through the woods for 19 hours. He's going to lay down and go to sleep.
Yeah.
And he said, besides that, to make that amount of miles in that amount of time would be difficult for an adult, even during the daytime, over two mountain ranges and over several barbed wire fences. And honestly, I think that was the one case where we've had the most feedback on, where people said, wow, how did that boy do that?
Exactly. When you bring in a survivalist, expert, hiker, outdoorsman to replicate it, it seems to be a different situation. And I don't know if I feel that all of these missing people are connected, but some of them, I think there had to have been some sort of abduction. Some of them, I think maybe they ran off into the woods. But for this little boy to appear so far away in such a short amount of time, I just assume somebody snatched him up and then took an ATV, took some sort of vehicle, drove roads, and then dumped him later. That's my only logical explanation for this.
Yeah, and that's the part where it gets to be difficult. When you try to apply logic to it, you quickly lose it. And just like you said, well, somebody had an ATV. Well, obviously ATV tracks are going to show up in the snow. They're going to show up in the mountains. Mm-hmm. Or somebody took them. Well, then you know, there's going to be tracks. There's going to be a scent trail. There's going to be something. And then when you start to grind through the data, none of this stuff exists. And so how did that little kid do that? But in several of my books, I have tables at the back. And when I'm speaking in front of a conference, oftentimes I'll bring it out and I'll show people, I'll ask them, well, how many people in this audience have kids? And people raise their hands. And I said, okay, now if you were in the woods and you let your two-year-old be alone and you left, what would they do? And some of them say, well, they'd play in the dirt for 15, 20 minutes till they got tired. And they'd lay down and go to sleep. Others said, well, they'd, you know, walk 20 feet, 30 feet downhill until they found something interesting, and then they'd start playing with it. And then I show them graphs and tables that show these 2 and 3 year old kids walking thousands of feet up into the mountains uphill. And nobody believes that their son or daughter would walk uphill. And when I talk about elevation gain in the mountains, that's just not elevation gain at sea level. When you start walking 4,000 or 5,000 feet at 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and you're walking up into 8,000 or 9,000 feet, that takes a lot of effort, even for an adult.
Yeah.
And then you couple that with distance traveled. How far would a two-year-old travel? And when I show 10, 12, 15, 18 miles that a two-year-old travels supposedly on their own, nobody believes it. But yet I have the facts and the cases that it happens time and time again.
The age of the child is definitely surprising for me to hear. I know when I was a kid, my mom took me up into the mountains for a camping thing, and my sister was 2 years older than me. I think I was maybe 5 or 6, so she was 7 or 8. And we hauled off and ran up a mountain because we wanted to get to the top. And this mountain was way bigger than we anticipated. And by the time we got 2/3 of the way up, we found ourselves in a coyote den and decided this was time to go back. And somehow, some way, we found our way back. And, you know, I'm thinking of episodes of I Shouldn't Be Alive where people do get lost, you know, just right off the walking trail. And I know that these things are possible. I know that life is a lot more fragile than sometimes we like to think of it. But a two-year-old climbing up a mountain just doesn't click with me as easy as, say, a 5 or 10 year old. That I can buy into, because kids are curious and they want to explore and they want to get to the top of things. Whereas a 2 year old, I don't know how you resolve that, I guess.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/genY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/genY.
Well, there's, I mean, I've had everything thrown at me that you can imagine. Some people say, well, you're a fool. It's obviously some big eagle grabbed the kid and flew him out into the wild. And then I said, well, okay, but they found the body and there's no marks on the body. There's no place where talons grabbed the body. There's no bite marks, talon marks, claw marks. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. So how did he grab the kid? And then all of a sudden they stopped communicating.
An eagle, you know, bird attack is possible, but they're not going to attack. I mean, it just depends on, I guess, the size of the kid. But 20 pounds and up, that's a lot for any sort of predatory bird.
Yes. And usually if that happens, they're getting a downhill run at it. They're going to knock it downhill. Mm-hmm. And during that stage where they knock something downhill, they're going to disable it or hurt it. And most of the time, these kids, the parents describe them as being almost right next to me, or they were right there, and then they're gone. There's never anything heard. There's no screams, yells. There's nothing. It's a bizarre scenario.
I know that you're not afraid to say, I don't know, which I very much appreciate about you, because it's not a bad thing. You're collecting information. You're collecting data. You're trying to show people, hey, going up into a national park isn't the safest place all the time. There can be accidents. There can be a lot of situations. But in some of these cases, do you lean more to somebody running off, or do you lean more to abduction, or is it just case by case?
So I think you can remove the human-to-human abduction because there's no tracks, there's no scent. So the commonplace abductions that we tend to think about, that's impossible. And a lot of times there's an adult who disappears or a young teenager. And what I talk about, there's a lot of cases in Colorado. There's a cluster. There's multiple clusters in Colorado on my map. And here in Colorado, I can tell you that probably 70% of the people on the trail in the backcountry carry a gun. Mm-hmm. And if somebody tried to abduct somebody on a trail in Colorado, it'd be a shootout. It'd be people dead. But you never hear about that. And I don't think that the human-to-human abduction is something relatively common in the least, because there's a couple of problems. First of all, you get a human on the trail and they don't want to comply, you got a problem. Because there's only a few places you can escape to, and there's only a few places that you could have parked your car, and there's probably a lot of people who have seen that car. So you're in a big heap of trouble. And then the problem is, if the person complies, and let's say you mortally injure the person, what are you going to do with the body? You can't carry a dead body very far at all. Dead weight weighs a lot. And when you're at altitude, that'll drain you quickly. Usually people aren't walking around on hikes with shovels. So then what do you do with it? And I could go on and on, but all of the facts surrounding the disappearances point away from human involvement.
There's always a trace of some sort, unless it's, say, on a roadway and you jump in their car and they take off. But anywhere else, there's typically some sort of track. I mean, to go up hiking in a lot of these mountains, you have to wear big boots or at least some sort of shoe. It's going to leave a shoe print. So it's very mysterious. And with a lot of the cases, especially on your documentary, these people, these families, they're out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, how is some stranger going to come up just randomly on them and then take off with their child? It's just the probabilities of it are very slim. Also, even if that does happen, they wouldn't see this person. It's just weird, especially the first story on your documentary where the grandfather's sitting with the grandson, and maybe he turns his head and he's drinking his beer for 5 minutes, and then the kid is completely gone. And they scour the entire place. He's not gone for more than an hour, and they cover square miles of that mountainside looking for him. And there's only one road in and one road out. So if somebody abducted the kid, did they drive up there? Well, no one saw the car. And then you think, well, what's around there? They're not carrying the kid miles, over mountaintops. It's just eerie. When I was watching that documentary, I thought, what? That doesn't compute, but it's something that I'm glad that you're documenting it, because apparently nobody else is keeping track of these things. And that's what I appreciate, at least about the books and the documentary. But how did you come about doing the documentary? How did you shift gears from the books to a movie?
Well, we were trying to find a way to reach a different segment of society that wasn't willing to read a book. And we know a lot of people like watching YouTube, so we did some YouTube videos. If you go to YouTube and type in Can-Am, like Canadian American, Can-Am Missing Project, you'll find our videos. But we were thinking, well, maybe we could do some kind of low budget thing and Then we kept talking about it and said, you know, we could probably get a decent amount of money from the supporters of the books by going to Kickstarter. And we ended up getting a large amount, $150,000. And we blew through that. And the standard documentary costs about $250,000 to $300,000 to make. So we had way under that amount. And yet I think we were able to come in and the skill of the directors and the videographers, I think we brought forth something that was professional, and it made the point that we wanted to make.
Absolutely. And it was exceptionally done. The shots are beautiful. The treatment of the families, the victims, is very kind and respectful. I can't recommend the documentary any more than that. It's just really well done. And I didn't know what to expect when I watched it. You know, I thought it might go down crazy rabbit holes. I thought maybe some of the law enforcement or families might be portrayed in less than desirable ways, but the emotion and the passion, it really comes through. And maybe law enforcement doesn't like the way they're portrayed in it, but hey, it's their words. But I really appreciated Alan's input on there and putting a face to the voice. I really appreciated that. Where can people go out and find the documentary if they want to watch it?
So if you go to canammissing.com, mm-hmm. like CanadianAmericanMissing.com, that's our website, and you want to purchase a DVD or Blu-ray, you can do that. You can go to Amazon, you can go to iTunes and rent it for a short period of time and watch it. It's pretty cheap, but hey, we appreciate everyone's feedback and understand I've probably heard everything by now. And the one thing I'll preface is that I have never met anybody that's read any of the six books and come back and said, I have an answer for you about what's happening, because they all say there's not one answer that fits all of the profile points that we line up in those books.
No, that's where I can look at individual cases and think I can lean certain ways on certain ones, but there's no universal answer for all of these. And you have so many cases that you document. And I'm sure anyone reading through the books, some of them will resonate more and some of them, you know, just, okay, that's just more information now. It's just another case that's very eerily similar to this one. Now, your first book was North America, correct?
First one was a very large book, and we split it. It's Missing 411 Eastern U.S., and then there's Missing 411 Western U.S. And it's just by geographical area. We split them up. They came out almost at the same time. Then there was Missing 411 North America and Beyond, Missing 411 The Devil's in the Detail, and then there was Missing 411 A Sobering Coincidence, and then the latest one is Missing 411 Hunters, and it's about hunters that have disappeared in the wild.
And you've expanded. You've gone national. You've gone international now, and you're getting stories of the missing from all the way to Australia, right?
Oh yeah. In fact, last summer I did a speaking tour of Australia. It's Australia, Canada, and the UK are the, in conjunction with the US, are the top four locations in the world for disappearances that match this profile.
I can't recommend the books enough, and the documentary is exceptional. I need to rewatch it with my wife because I had to watch it in a rush situation. So I just sat down and went through it very quickly. And then my wife's like, what are you watching? I'm like, oh, it's Missing 411. She goes, oh, well, can we watch it? I'm like, we'll have to watch it next week after I interview the director. So, you know, I was very pleased with it. And I just want listeners to know that if you haven't seen it, go watch it. Don't go out on YouTube and find bits and pieces of it. Just go watch it. It is well worth the money. And subscribe, do whatever from whatever website you watch your videos from. Just fork over the few bucks. It's totally worth it.
I think you come away with a different perception of the reality of the wilderness.
Well, absolutely. My co-host, Aaron, he actually went on a search and rescue volunteer mission in Liberty, Missouri, and he was on the team. They were going through. They could not find this person, and one of the members of his team really wanted to search this other area. It was like a construction site that had porta potties. And the lead of the search and rescue team, whoever it was like, no, we're doing this place here. We're not going over there. The man they were searching for, he ended up being in one of those porta potties. He had a massive heart attack while he was in there, and they didn't find him until days later.
That's sad.
Yeah. And it's just one of those things where I'm thinking, you know, I get you want to focus on a certain area, but if you have enough manpower or whatever, you could broaden your horizons. Let's go through, let's find this person. And it was just very telling to me that you can not find somebody and be 100 feet from them, but it's just, it's a mysterious thing. And I know that search and rescue folks here in Missouri are highly trained. And again, this is not a knock on them. Like you said, they are doing a wonderful job. And then the search dogs, I met some at CrimeCon just last month, and highly trained dogs. I believe in the dogs. I've seen scenarios where they have a drug dog find a package of drugs inside of a warehouse, that's inside of a box, that's inside of a bucket full of bleach, and this dog found the drugs. You know, it's like, that's impressive. I've seen other search dogs track people. I think there's a Mythbusters episode too, where they track people through a creek. You run through a river or a creek and the dog tracks you. It's like, what? How is that possible? But it is.
Yeah, I've actually participated in searches where suspects have done that. So, and then, you know, it's,
yeah,
they're good.
Yeah, I believe in the dogs. That's all I got to say.
They're very good.
So, was there anything else you want to share with the listeners before I let you go?
Well, I would say buy the movie or rent the movie at Amazon and iTunes. Do not buy my books at Amazon, as we don't sell on Amazon. You're going to see them for sale there between $50 and $125 each.
Ouch.
Yeah, we sell them for $24.99 on our website. So those are resellers trying to gouge you, so don't fall for that trick.
Good catch.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And I always like the artist, the content producer, to get credit and to get paid for what they're doing. I've become a big advocate for that. So spent most of my life pirating stuff, and now I know better. I really want to tell people, please go out and buy his books from him and rent his movie, buy his movie, because it's worth it.
Well, thanks a million, Justin. I appreciate it very much.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Dave.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
to deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.